Well, thank you indeed, Everil, Emily, David, distinguished guests. I'm pleased to be here because at the inauguration of a new body focused on the ageing, age and the ageing, this is a really important thing for us as a society. And so, what are we calling it? The Centre for Applied Policy in Positive Ageing, CAPA. I'm happy to be here at its inauguration and its launch. I got interested in aged care at a very early stage in my parliamentary life. I was elected House Representative in 1969, and there was a gentleman, Dr. Gary Andrews. He ran what was then called the Lidcombe Old Men's Home, and he set up a thing with this Bankstown Council, municipal council, called the Bankstown Council Geriatric Committee, and he asked me would I like to join it, and I said I would, because I was always, you know, knew that there was a big problem in this area, and Dr. Andrews' specialisation was in geriatrics, and he later became a director of the New South Wales health system, Department of Health for Western Sydney, I think it was, and I lost track of him some decade later. He started to, you know, to turn my interest in these discussions, and I used to think I had a lot of respect for my parents' generation. These are people who had weathered the Depression and the Second World War, the poverty of the Depression, the scant and limited means of the post-war years. In my case, they lived in their fibro houses in Bankstown, and when their husbands died, their widows lived in the isolation and relative poverty of their fibro houses. And there was never, it seemed to me, even for those who remained as couples and in retirement, that there was a sort of a sensible system to look after them. So this is where I began my interest in this. And I maintained this all through my parliamentary life. And when I became Treasurer, I started to take a more active interest in geriatrics and in aged care. And when Brian Howe became Minister for Social Security, he and I set up the ACAT system of aged care assessment, and we set up home and community care, HAC, to bring support to people to stay at home. And also we had a program of capital subventions for low care and high care in nursing homes, so-called. We wanted to, in those days, there were too many people in nursing homes. And nursing homes had, you know, people who were still ambulant sitting and sleeping beside someone who was chronically ill and often dying. So, and the bed day costs of nursing homes were so profoundly large that there was obviously a need for a big policy shift to get people who were aged, but ambulant, simply in a better circumstance than they might have been able to find themselves at home, and where they had some group accommodations like meals, etc., some modest medical care if necessary, some company and enjoyment, and where we took them out of this sort of nursing home structure where they were definitely not prospering and where the cost to the Commonwealth Government was very high. And so this is where the sort of so-called hostel program got to kick along, and we put new capital into it. And also to bring it to an even standard. For instance, some states had a much higher standard than others. And so Brian Howe and I introduced a program of bringing the standards together by lifting bed day subsidies and construction subsidies, operating subsidies in some states, and withdrawing them and diminishing them others, so we had them more even more even over the period. And of course, this was accompanied by taking the pension to 25% of average weekly earnings, which gave, because in those days, you know, with earnings, particularly in the 90s, 80s and 90s, with earnings growth growing, it meant that pensions were more valuable. So there was this kind of history, and of course, overlaying that was how we actually got people something better in retirement in terms of income maintenance and wealth than simply the age pension or other than simply or solely the age pension. And of course, this is where I first began to think about occupational superannuation. Now, it always got up my nose that superannuation existed for managers and the wealthy and the executive class and broadly the public service, and not much in between for ordinary working men and women. And I always knew that the key to wealth is compound earnings. But how do you get compound earnings? You get it by preservation. You get it by not touching the money. And the people in this society who have great wealth have always had investments and compound earnings, but the average working person had their house and their mortgage and the Commodore, and that was about it. And they had the pension, which was of its essence an anti-destitution measure. It wasn't really a high maintenance income. So it was a matter of trying to see how we could actually make a shift from superannuation, as it was more or less for a privileged group in the community, without overdoing the word privilege, but let's say a better off group in the community and the broad workforce. And so in the 1983 budget, I made the first move on reform of superannuation by changing the tax treatment on lump sums. In those days, lump sums were taxed as to 5% of the sum at what was then the 60% top marginal rate. So the effective rate of tax, 60% of 5 is 3, so the tax rate was 3%. So you paid your 3% and out you went, you had your money more or less free, and that was it. And of course, there was no preservation, so you could take it out any time. This particularly worked against women who would leave the workforce to have children. They'd get their $23,000 or their $31,000 or whatever it was, and they'd take it away with them, and they'd lose any chance of compound earnings or continuity, and they'd come back and have to start again. So one of the first things I did was to set up a thing called approved deposit funds, so that people could take from one job their lump sum and put it in an approved deposit fund, and that could continue earning while ever they might have been, if they were women having children or a family, or in the case of a male changing work or workforce, so they could come back to it. They wouldn't have to just simply take the money. Now, this brought on a very big fight with the ACTU, because a lot of people, working people, regarded this lump sum as a sort of little interim capital hit that they could have on the way through. And being a decent sort of bunch of unionists, they all fought to hang on to every bit of capital that came their way. But Bill Kelty, who was much smarter than the rest of them, could see that what I was intending was that I said, we cannot provide superannuation to the whole workforce if the tax rate is so concessional as to be only 3% on an accumulation. Just impossible for the budget to carry this. And he said, you think we could extend this to the whole workforce? I said, well, I think we could extend it to the whole workforce, but it would have to be around a structure that was sustainable. And of course, the central element of that was preservation. And preservation is a compact which is now being often abused, but it is a serious compact between the community and the government. It says fundamentally, if you're prepared to defer consumption for 30 years, we'll give you a concessional rate of taxation on your accumulation. Yeah? And the broad organised workforce put their hand up for that. Most Australians now put their hand up for that. And so they agreed to defer their consumption for 30 odd years and preserve their savings, and as a consequence, the government, the Commonwealth of Australia, gives them a rate of concessionality on the earnings of that pool of accumulation of funds, which is concessional to the kind of marginal rates they would apply to ordinary income. So the question was, how, if we set up a set of rules like preservation, how would we then get superannuation going? And Bill and I decided we would do it first industrially. When we took to the Commission against, of course, ACCI, you know, ACCI's still around. It's an association of the Chamber of Commerce. You know, it's fundamentally a blight on society, but it's still there. They opposed it, of course, and the Commission agreed to the 3%. So that was 1% a year over 3 years to get to the first 3% industrially as part of a sharing of productivity. You see, in the general accord process that existed between the ACTU and the government, we had a shift in the factor shares between wages and profits. And we had real wage declines to restore competitiveness and a shift in profitability to lift investment. So within that real wage decline and with then the productivity shooting out of the structural reforms of the cabinet, of the Hawke government, the economic reforms, including in things like the tariff cuts, et cetera, we could see that we could actually defer 1% of cash income into savings, and we could get that 1% put away as superannuation. So in any long journey, you've got to begin somewhere, so we thought we'd start with a one. The first one took 3 years to get anywhere. The employers resisted it and tried to pretend it was a cost on them, where it was in fact just a deferred cash income, deferred wages. So we got took 5 years to get the first 3% up, and then we went to the Commission for the second 3%, which was declined by the Conciliation Arbitration Commission by the Vice President of the Commission, whose name escapes me now. I think it was Keogh, but I can't remember. Anyway, he knocked this claim out. The employers all applauded. So I said to Bill Kelty, if you can get occupational superannuation to 3% industrially for 60% of the workforce, I'll legislate for the other 40% to get the 3%. And then when the Commission knocked off the second 3%, I told him I would legislate for 6% in all. And I gave the ACTU that commitment. What happened was I then, that was all moving, those things have been said, but they said within the councils of the government and the ACTU rather than publicly. And Bob Hawke, I resigned as treasurer in June 1991, and John Kerrin was appointed. And Bob Hawke and John Kerrin wanted to run out on the legislative commitment, the 3% and the 6%. So I said to Bill, just tell Bob we'll just rip the accord up and rip his head off on the way through. So I made a speech at the Graduate School of Management at the University of New South Wales, where I said that I believed we should get to a compulsory superannuation scheme of 12% of wages, and that the government should legislate to 12%. This was the kind of made explicit by me from the backbench of the kind of commitment I'd given Bill Kelty and the ACTU a little earlier. Now, what happened was, under pressure, Bob collapsed, of course, and John Kerrin announced in the budget that they would take the superannuation guarantee charge, as it was then called, to 9% of wages, not 12, because the Treasury always opposed occupational superannuation, still opposes occupational superannuation. The Treasury is the gang that can't shoot straight. unless they have a treasurer with a rifle sight and a pair of crosshairs, without direction. It's a competent facilitatory department, but it has absolutely no imagination. So they opposed it. They talked them down from 12 to 9. And so then when I became Prime Minister at the end of 1991, and then into 1992, I legislated the 9 as had been announced in the previous budget. But you may know, in the 1995 budget, Ralph Willis announced we would take the 9 to 15%. So we would have had a 15% superannuation scheme had I won the 1996 election. John Howard cancelled that commitment after having said in the election campaign he would keep it. So we got stuck at 9. So that's the history of how the 9 started, and then it took us, we had to catch up the people who had no bargaining power in the labour market, who had not got the first 3 or 6%, and then from 1991 we started the steps up to 9, finishing in 2001, where everybody in the workforce had 9% by 2001. Now, when you think about a system of ageing and income maintenance, and we say, well, what is the standard? Where do we want to get to? Well, there's all sorts of judgments about this, but a lot of people say you need to get to around 70% of your income in your last year or week at work in retirement. Roughly 70% would keep you in the kind of style of life you had become accustomed during your working life. And if that is the objective, and by the way, I don't think it is the objective at the moment, but it was certainly my objective. If we had that as the objective, we would get to 70%. You can get to 70%, but you can't get there with 9%. You can't get there even with 9.5%. You can get there with 12, just with 12, but now as yields are falling, it's even doubtful whether we get to 70 with 12, but at least you would need to get to 12. And of course, the government's running around this week saying we won't touch super, but they've already touched it. They've knocked the 12 down to 9.5. They've already knocked off 2.75%, you know? And this is rather tragic because, you know, the last Labor government announced it would go to 12. The coalition said they would support it, said so in the election campaign, and of course now they were then going to bring it in 2022, and now it's gone. It's not likely to be there at all. So the whole popular support for adequacy and increasing the SGC to 12% of wages, which was around in the broad community and is probably still around, is being done in by this tomfoolery about jamming the superannuation guaranteed charge at 9.5%, you know. And this is all about the budget can't afford it. What would otherwise be the taxation of ordinary income. But again, will the budget be able to afford the pensions in 30 years' time, which would be diminished, the pension call on the budget diminished by the compound earnings that these things, and that's the question that Treasury, of course, never asks itself. So we're now jammed at 9.5%, which is a bad outcome, we are not going to get to anything like the 70%. And then, of course, as well as that, we've had Peter Costello and his budget was in 2005-06 made all superannuation savings over 63, which made the system more expensive. You might remember I had the reasonable benefits limits, which were 1.5 million, where you kept the concessional rate of tax. And that was indexed. That was from 1995, I think. So indexed 1.5 million from 1995, and you're probably about 2.5 or 2.6 or 2.7 now. So you could have had that, and then any money you had over that got taxed at ordinary marginal rates. Well, they abolished the reasonable benefits limits, and of course, I was taxing lump sums, but I was prepared to drop the tax on the lump sum if you bought an annuity. So what I was trying to do was develop a whole system of annuities. where we would encourage superannuants to sort of trade their lump sum in for annuities, etc. Now, we're in a world today where you can just see, notwithstanding the operation of the US Federal Reserve or the European Central Bank or the Bank of Japan with these quantitative easings, bond yields, mostly 10-year bond yields, mostly track around nominal GDP. Now, Australia's nominal GDP has been around, let's say, 2.5% for inflation and 3.5% for growth, around 6%. So 10-year bonds, roughly 6%. Those nominal GDP numbers, and that 6% in a super fund, if you could get nominal GDP, maybe plus one, you're really doing well. But at least nominal GDP, six. That's now declining because inflation, we've got a lot of deflation around the world, and now central banks have actually got targets for inflation, not for bringing inflation down, but for bringing inflation up. And the American Federal Reserve target's 2%. Now, let's say we go to a 2% or sub 2% inflationary world, and growth in countries like Australia will probably do better. But let's say here you're talking about 2, but growth with a 2 in front of it, Europe will be 1.5, the United States will be 2.5. If you put the 2 together, you can call them 2. You're looking at nominal GDP of about 4%. It's a lot lower than it used to be. It was always around 6 or 5. In Australia, we'd be looking at nominal GDP of probably, 2.2 for inflation and about probably 3.2 for growth, which is about, 5.5? And we used to have 6.5. So 1% of nominal GDP makes a very big difference. GDP is $1,500 billion. 1% is $15 billion to the budget, simply on the budget revenue, And in terms of earnings, it makes a huge difference in a superannuation pool. So we have to take account for the fact now that yields are probably going to come down and superannuants are going to have to search further for risk rather than simply take fixed interest at very low rates of interest, 3 or 3.5 or 4, as these yields are compressed, as government bond yields are compressed. So this will mean that our propensity to invest more riskily in super in equity markets will need to obtain because yields in fixed interest are simply too low to help people maintain a standard of living in retirement as well as receiving the full or part pension. So it means that we have to at least get to 12% in the accumulation. To be at 9.5% with yields like this, and particularly if you get to someone over 60 or 65 and the balance slips to prudence and you go more heavily fixed interest and less heavily equities, then even 12% basically is battling to make it. But to have less than 12 is really a piece of economic vandalism. That's what it is, And why is it? Well, of course, the coalition doesn't like compulsory superannuation. They give you this nonsense about, well, we believe in choice. Yeah, the choice to be on the bones of your backside in retirement, that's the choice you get, The choice not to save. The choice to lose the compound earnings. The choice not to see the capital accumulations grow. This is nonsense. This is not freedom of action or freedom of choice. It's just a sort of willful subjugation of what has been a national project. Yeah? And that's what it is. And the commitment is there. The public, we accept the commitment. We will defer our consumption, even for 30 or 35 years, for a concessional rate of taxation and the ability to see our savings compound. And so every time we cut across these things, we see them go badly. Now, when I introduced this scheme in 1985, the first 3% with the ACTU, I was intending a superannuation scheme that covered people from roughly 58, 60 years of age to about 80, 81. That's how long they lived then. And at the levels we're talking about, 12% of wages, you would easily get an accumulation which would do exactly what you wanted it to do. But in those 30 odd years since, people are living 9 years longer in the main, which is a phenomenal number in itself. And so as a consequence of living 9 years yet longer, we're now talking about people living to 90, or their children and my children, and my generation's children, living to 90, you know, the 95 or even 100, you know, but certainly in their 90s. My children's grandparents, my mother's 94, and their grandmother on the maternal side is 95. So they've got a reasonable chance of hitting the ton, which is a long way away. So we've now got this longevity issue, and the moral of that tale is this: that you can't work for 35 years from, say, when you start accumulating money at, say, let's call it 30 to 65, and expect a 35-year accumulation to last you 35 years after that. You just can't do it. It just cannot be done. So the promise of a decent retirement income can't be met. The Commonwealth's implicit promise of a decent retirement income cannot be met on those aggregates. And so we have to think about longevity and ageing and think about super in two ways. My original scheme, which was, let's say, as I said a moment ago, 55, 58, say 60 to 80. Let's call that superannuation phase one. And then there's superannuation phase two, which is 80 to 100. And we now, as a country, have to start focusing on superannuation phase two, 80 to 100, because already, you know, my eldest child is 38, my youngest is 29. You know, they're already moving into these things, and they're starting, the accumulation needs to be there now. Now, what do we do about this? How do we cope with this longer age and longevity and income adequacy, leaving aside for a moment issues like geriatric assessment, healthcare, accommodation, diagnostic imaging, pathology, and all the other things we know are there? Well, I think that originally in Ralph Willis's budget of 1995, I wanted super going to 15%. And the reason I did was for the baby boom generation, because they didn't really get into it until the 1990s. And by that stage, they've been in the workforce a very long part of their lives, and they didn't have enough time to develop their pool. So what I said to Ralph, what we need to do is front-end load this. So the big boom in equities, which happened from 2002 to 2007, the one that stopped with the global financial crisis, all of that wealth would have attached to the full 15% if Howard had agreed to stick with the 95 budget proposals, where 3% of tax cuts for 3% were paid into superannuation accounts, and the other 3% was a co-payment by the workforce. So the workforce put an extra 1% a year for 3 years, and the Commonwealth paid the tax cuts as savings, not cash, 1% a year for 3 years. So we would have got the 15%. And that 15% for the baby boomers would have really front-end loaded their accumulation with a pickup in world equities 2002 to 8, because the 15% would have been in the slot by 2001. So they would have been sitting there fully funded, 15, up thing. That didn't happen, so they lost it. Now I've changed my mind about the 15% because, A, I don't think the political system will do it, and secondly, I don't really want to just leave the long-run 80 to 100 cohort at the whim and caprice of world equity and fixed interest markets and privately managed superannuation funds. So I now believe that the right answer for Australia is that we set up a Commonwealth insurance longevity fund where a certain percentage of wages would be paid, like the Medicare levy, to the fund, and the fund would guarantee you, would provide you with a guaranteed, calibrated, carefully constructed product which looked after your income in the 80 to 100 period and also gave you commitments as to housing, accommodation and healthcare. And this is a classic job for insurance. You've got insurance companies all around the place that cover life insurance every day of the week. But what commercial insurance can't do is insure across generations, and they can't pool risk like the Commonwealth can insure across generations and pool risk. So let's say 1, 2 or 3% of wages went in your working life to this fund, and of course this would then earn, just like the future fund, with compound earnings. And then, of course, the person who dies at 63, their contributions remain there for the person who lives to 93. So in other words, it's a classic insurance proposition. Like, you insure your house, everyone on the street insures their house, but one house burns down, they get paid from the premiums that the rest of the neighbours have paid for their houses, which have remained intact. It's the same insurance principle you would have in this system. And it seems to me that if the Commonwealth is a default insurer anyway through the age pension. Through the age pension, if there is an adequacy in private savings, the Commonwealth will be the default insurer through the age pension. Even if it's an age pension not of today's calibration or size, it'll still be the default insurer. So if it is the default insurer, if it can pool risk, if it can carry risk across generations, then the Commonwealth picks itself out as the operator, as the agency, which is better focused to manage the 80 to 100 cohort than the private for-profit funds management industry. So I think we should see a system where the 60 to 80 cohort and that capital is kept, managed, accumulated by the private for-profit funds management industry, and we try and turn those capitals into income, either by way of annuities or something, and that'll take people out to sort of 80 or 82 or 83 years of age. But you can't expect the savings of 30 years to carry you in a decent standard of living for a following 30 years. It just cannot happen. It's not a piece of rubber that you can continue to stretch, which means we have to be thinking now about the 80 to 100 cohort. In other words, we have to be thinking now about superannuation phase two. And this is what you're doing in your centre, which is on this very topic of longevity and ageing. Now, frankly, these are not hard things to do. You know, we've got this sort of hiatus between the parties, but it's a combination of sort of, you know, ideological niggardliness about the Conservatives not liking occupational superannuation or compulsory superannuation, and then everyone having a go at the cost structure, including the Labor Party, about the cost of the system. Now, the Costello freebie after 60 can't remain. That will have to change. But that's only a small part of the problem. The big design issue is where we go with adequacy. We can't stay at 9.5%. We have to go to 12 at least, and quickly. And then where do we go with the 80 to 100 cohort? That's the second part. Now, this is where I'm going to say something about something you mightn't expect, which is important to this, and this is another thing I established called dividend imputation. Dividend imputation was introduced in the 1985 tax package and then implemented in 1986 to remove the double taxation of dividends. And you might think, well, this is a good capitalist thing to do. Of course, there's a little subtext here. I used to always say to the Labor Party, who had this complete confusion between ends and means, that the Liberals could never do capital. And the Liberals today can still not do capital, you know. a Labor government comes along and sets up a pool of nearly $2 trillion in savings in superannuation and linking it through into the equity markets through dividend imputation. I mean, it's, you know, apparently Warren Buffett talks about this in his private meetings, about such a structure. You know, $2 trillion, 24 million of us, locked into the equities market through dividend imputation. You know, I mean, if you're a Liberal Treasurer, you'd go down on a bended knee about it, wouldn't you? Whether a Labor Treasurer introduced it or not. You know. But, you see, it's not understood. Now, I'll tell you what dividend imputation did. Before I turned up, the managers and the boards, the old boards, the old guys with their moustaches and their tweed coats, used to blow the money. What they did, they never paid dividends. There was no tension between managers and owners, between shareholders and boards, because there was no benefit in paying a dividend. As a consequence, they overgeared to run down their income tax. They were pumped full of debt and blew up regularly. They retained all their capital retentions. And what they do to stop someone taking them over, they would acquire another company, invariably value destroying for the original business. Or if they weren't in some big merger and acquisition, they would simply grow in an ungainly way, grow organically the business, blowing inefficiently using the capital. When dividend imputation came along, it forced them to meet a standard for the first time ever. And the standard was you have to pay the shareholders a dividend. So you've got to now run your capital much more efficiently than you did in the past, where the only kicks you got on Route 66 was selling your shares in the stock market free of tax. Shouldn't be before the capital gains tax. Sale of shares were free. So they didn't pay dividends, and so therefore the argument went all the benefits accrued in the share price and you took the gains free. So what more did you want? Well, how can you build a society when the passive production of capital was untaxed but the dynamic production of income was double taxed? You know? How can you do this? As I said to the Labor cabinet in 1985, how can we build a society where income in a company is being taxed twice, equity is being taxed twice, and debt's being taxed once? Like, this is mad. But more than that, the gains untaxed completely. So by establishing a capital gains tax and removing the double tax on dividends, we put this tension on to the corporate system not to overgear, not to waste the capital, and to pay dividends. And then I then locked the superannuation system and dividend imputation together in 1987. So I put a 15% tax on fund earnings, 15% on the way in and 15% in, encouraging the super funds to then go and buy franking stocks that pay fully franked dividends. So if you look at the average fund today, which is 15% tax, their real rate of tax is about 6. So they buy enough equities, so they buy, you know, the frankers, Commonwealth Bank, Westpac, BHP, Telstra, etc., and they get the franking credits. You can't pay a franking credit to a non-taxpaying body. So I turned super funds into a taxpaying body so they could receive the imputed credits. And they'll buy enough of them to get their average rate of tax down to about 6, and they'll all be about the same, whether you talk to Australian Super or AMP, or they'll all be about 6% in the fund because they'll buy enough franking credits. Now, what does this mean for retirement incomes? Well, it means a lot, because what it means is that, I'll just make one aside here. One of the reasons we got through the 2007-08 crisis was because our companies were not overgeared. They were not sitting like bloated oafs on the pavement ready to explode, like, you know. What happened was the crisis came, and one of the reasons we didn't have the big problems we used to have is because dividend imputation forced the boards and the managers not to overgear to reduce their tax, because if they reduced their tax, they couldn't frank their credits. And if they couldn't frank their dividends, the super funds wouldn't buy their stock. And if the super funds wouldn't buy their stock, their share price fell. And because all the managers' contracts were tied to the share price, they all believed that their own remuneration packages would be about maintaining the share price, and that meant paying your full corporation tax, which meant the Treasury's tax collections just rocketed as a consequence. So dividend imputation was a revolution for Australia, a Labor Party revolution, I must say. And, well, part of the Labor Party revolution, to be honest. But what it's done, it's made the management of Australian capital so much more efficient, and it's produced dividends. And these dividends are now linked into superannuation. So we've got a corporate system which is now pumping value into the retirement income system through this. And it means that the beta, the disparity in the price of stocks in our market, is far less than, say, the American stock market, because dragging a line, a dividend line through our stock market, which is twice, dividends are at least twice what those paid in the American stock market, means that you don't get the beta. You don't get the great swings up and you don't get the great swings down. So that means that the super funds and our retired age people who have their money in the stock market are not as in a position of jeopardy as they would be in these big beta swingers as they have in the United States, where everyone just takes the capital profits and they don't get any dividends. So you can't believe this, that the Treasury, which is the first recipient of the compulsion to pay full corporation tax in these unbelievably high levels of taxation compliance in Australia, I'm not talking about the foreign multinationals, the Australian companies that get the imputed credits, the compliance is off the charts. And the Treasury now issued a discussion paper saying, oh, well, dividend imputation's a cost, it's another tax expenditure, cost of revenue, and the rest of the world taxes income to us, and why don't we? Because the answer is, we have a superior system, that's why. We have the world's best system, that's why. And that world system is tied into the super scheme, and that's why we can pay. So you can go and buy Westpac stock today, it pays you an unfranked dividend of 5, and with the franking credits, 2%, you get 7 franked. I mean, an American Treasury bond is 1.6. A junk bond is 2.5 or 6 in America. Here you can go and buy CBA or Westpac and get 7% fully franked. It's part of the structure. And of course, now let me say, I'll finish on these points about the welfare industry. Superannuation was never designed. People say, what was it for? Well, if you want to know what it's for, ask the author. The author will tell you it's for lower and middle income Australia. That's what it's for. That was what I intended it for. That's what it is for. It was never meant to be a welfare measure. That's not to say that people who are less than one times average weekly ordinary time earnings, or people on part-timers on 50% or 75% of average weekly ordinary time, shouldn't be looked after in retirement. But you look after them with payments off the budget. You look after them with rebates. You don't look after them by warping the system with this sort of, the sort of ACOS refrain, what about the people down the bottom? You've got all these rich fat cats up the top. What about the ordinary cats in the middle, the cats who do all the work, the people on 100% of average weekly earnings up to 300%, right? The people on 70, 65 grand up to 200,000. This is what the scheme is designed for. And if we forget the purpose of the scheme and we start mucking around with the tax rates, the thing will collapse. The Treasury wants to get super taxed at full marginal rates of tax with rebates. And I said to Ken Henry when he put this in his paper a couple of years ago, I said, Ken, listen, you're asking these people to defer consumption for 35 years, which they happily agree to do on the basis of some concessionality. And then when you've got the fish in the barrel, you start shooting them in the barrel, you want to tax them at full marginal rates. Oh no, you're going to be very equitable and you're going to give the rebates back. I said, well, you would, Ken, but when you're not the Treasury Secretary and some other person's there, they say, oh, Treasurer, there's actually a saving here. We can actually cut the rebates back. So they've got you in the barrel at full marginal rates of tax and then they cut the rebates back. Now, that's where the Treasury is going all the time. Why is the Treasury going there? Because it cannot think straight. Right? Believe me. And they don't understand the bigger, larger picture. And then in the same time, as they want to get people on full marginal rates, they want to shoot a hole through dividend imputation. Give me a break, you know? So this is what we're dealing with. Now, is all this reparable and could it be done quickly? Yes. What's it need? Some imagination, some goodwill, and some leadership. That's it, you know? You can set up superannuation part two with a big insurance fund quite quickly and quite easily, and we could, within 3 years, bring the 9.5% to 12, you know? So we could get the bones of it there rather fast. But it's like all reform things, you've actually got to want to do it, you know, for the country. You've actually got to want to do it. And the parties, you know, I remember Marty Feldstein, he was the council of the chairman of economic advisors to President Reagan, you know, one of the two or three great American economists. In fact, he fell out with Reagan over the Reagan tax cuts and resigned as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, a very distinguished fellow. And he said to me, and he's the author of the George W. Bush tax cuts, he said to me, "Paul, you have one of the strangest conservative parties in the world." He said, "A Labor government comes along and convinces the workforce to save 15% of their income, and the Conservative Party says, no, it's too good for them." He said, "I don't understand it, honestly, I don't understand it." And that is part of the problem. You see, until the Libs basically accept the idea of compulsory savings and preservation and not ratting the larder by letting the money out for housing or letting it out for some other purpose, but keeping the accumulation together and over a long period of time, you must get that degree of bipartisanship to make the system work. And this goes for the Labor Party as well, you know. When Wayne Swan announced the increase in the super to 12%, he had four lots of a quarter, 2 years of 50 basis points, and then the last year of 100. So there was four quarters, which was 1%, 2 years of 0.5%, which was the second 1%, and the third year was the third 1%. So I said to him in his last budget, rather than kick off with 0.25, bring the 1% forward. So at least we take the 9 to 10. The system consolidates at 10, which is a round number and is 10% bigger than now anyway, you know, rather than 0.25. I said, because the Libs, it's like the fish in the barrel. They'll shoot this and jam it. And of course, guess what happened? We put the 0.25 in. The second just crept in over the line because of the Senate. Wasn't cooperating with the first hockey budget, and now it's jammed at 9.5%. So the Labor Party lost the opportunity of getting super to 10 immediately, and in the end, why? Because the Treasury didn't like it, you know. And I just said to Wayne, advisors will be on tap, not on top. And if you let the Treasury run you, you'll never put a policy together. Anyway, this is a big subject. It's important you're getting a focus on it. We've got to do something about it now, and it's got to be done reasonably quickly, because otherwise we won't have the time in savings and accumulation to make a difference. Thanks for having me, Ron.